Scotland, congratulations to on yet another fascinating lineup of Bristol Medical History. I don't know if you've got any fans here, but that was the Levellers group playing during the interval as you came back in. Singing of the joys of revolution and with equal enthusiasm of the joys of getting pissed, basically. The original Levellers were a bit more firm of purpose. The original agreement of the people was the sort of battle cry of the Levellers, and it can be summed up in one of the key phrases in it, that they wanted to make it appear to the world at how high a rate we value our just freedom. It's difficult to describe them, it would be premature to describe them as a party, but they were certainly the first democratic political movement in modern times. Now, before I go any further, I think I ought to own up. Somebody asked me a question about the Putney debates a few moments ago, which I wasn't able to answer. I'm not a historian, although I've been making television history programmes for a number of years now. They've been based... My own degree wasn't even in history. So I've relied very much on books, hence this little pile of books here, to reassure myself that I might be able to get through with some degree of credibility. But of course, as any real historian would tell you, what counts are primary sources rather than secondary sources, and most of these are secondary sources, i.e. books. Some of them, however, do go back to source. In particular, this one, the Geoffrey Robertson book, goes back and simply reproduces in full the documents of that period. There's another one here too, this one, the Levellers and the English Revolution, which similarly collects documents by the writers of that time. And it was there was a lot of agitation through writing was absolutely crucial to the Levellers. From that source material, insofar as I've got back to source material, it's clear that, first of all, it wasn't simply a manifesto. You can't identify what the Levellers were advocating in a kind of clearly laid out political manifesto. It's even clear that they objected to the name the Levellers themselves. They referred frequently to the Levellers so-called. It's not a name, it was a name they were given. The name Quakers were given the name and then took the name on, Methodists, similar process. But it's quite clear that from the outset, their support for democracy and their hostility to the monarchy is clear in everything that emerges, particularly the writing of Richard Overton, who was one of the most brilliant of the Leveller writers. And I'll just take a quote from this book, which is Geoffrey Robertson's collection of Leveller documents. We declare King Charles an enemy and publish your resolution, urges Parliament to publish your resolution never to have any more to do with him, but to acquit us of so great a charge and trouble forever. And to make it clear that this isn't simply an objection to this individual, to this specific king, but is an objection to monarchy as a whole, they refer to, a lovely phrase, king waste and delusion. And then further on in the document, the continual oppression of the nations have been kings. So it's clear that there was a strong, overwhelming anti-monarchist drive behind the Levellers. But the book that really set me going on the Levellers, it was one of these books that once I started to read, I just couldn't put it down and carried it everywhere with me. It's by Henry Brailsford, The Levellers and the English Revolution. Henry Brailsford was a radical journalist, one of the few left-wing journalists who objected to the show trials, the Stalin trials of the 1930s. And I think it's a fantastic book. Anyway, it really sort of got me going. And in particular, what got me going was that some of the sort of misgivings that I'd had about Cromwell, about the way, in fact, he began to take over the kind of powers of the king, and also, much more seriously, his policy in Ireland, which I have to say that in that sense, Geoffrey Robertson identified his major mistake as being identifying his son as the successor. It seems to me what he did in Ireland was absolutely appalling, and Brailsford focuses on that and makes a great feature of it. Let me find the relevant quote here. He talks about, he picks up on a quote from Lilburn, another Leveller spokesman. "You will consider how dangerous it is for one and the same persons to be continued long in the highest commands of military power, which was the original of most regalities and tyrannies in the world." In other words, a Leveller very early on in the Civil War, coming out strongly against the powers that Cromwell was taking onto himself, as well as in opposition to the king himself. And then, elsewhere in the book, if I can find the right bit, yes, please. This, I must say, at a particular time I read it, I had a great resonance for me. "The Levellers opposed the reconquest of Ireland with equal intelligence and moral courage. Their defence of the right of the Irish to keep their own fields and practice their own faith is the earliest and not the least distinguished instance in English history of the struggle of a popular party against imperialism." And this, I read that at a time that had a particular force for me. At the time, I was working for BBC on a documentary about the city of Derry, Londonderry. Depends which side of the divide you are, what you call it. There were three directors. More or less finished the film. I don't think any of us were particularly satisfied with it, but anyway, we delivered it, and the higher echelons of the BBC intervened to tell us that one particular sequence would have to be removed, and that was a shot of a mother coming to a graveyard in the Cregan, putting flowers on the grave, close shot of the flowers, tilt up the headstone, which read, "In loving memory of Sean, murdered by British paratroopers on Bloody Sunday." And we were told to remove that sequence from the programme. And because of that decision, I resigned from the BBC and I went to work for RT in Ireland, in Dublin. But before I went, I had a conversation with a friend, John McElbeck, who was a producer for BBC in Newcastle, and I told him about an idea I had. I'd forgotten about the James Naylor connection. To recreate the James Naylor story locally in Bristol for HTV West and treat it as if it was a contemporary event through the newsreaders, through the nightly news, regional news programme. ITV rejected that idea, but John Offenbeck, well, to whom I'm eternally grateful, said, "Why don't we do it with a Geordie leader of the Levellers, John Lilburn?" And that's what we did. To my amazement, he managed to get the BBC to contract me as the writer and director. And I'm going to run two extracts from it, but the first one is quite short, and I'll just to give you the sort of flavour of the story. If the year is 1647, let me just check. Yes. Lilburn had been imprisoned in the royalist period. He'd been tortured and imprisoned during Charles I's reign, become a popular hero at the time. Now, once again, at the time when the King Charles appeared to be defeated in 1647, the first phase of the Civil War, he was imprisoned again. And this caused such outrage that it gave tremendous sort of boost to the Leveller movement. And what I tried to do in this programme was to, well, there were two targets in a way. There was the BBC and the way it kind of shifted according to the prevailing orthodoxy. It just fascinated me to think what would happen in a period where almost overnight it's King Charles and then it's Charles Stuart and then it's that traitor Charles Stuart. And I just wondered how the sort of vicars of Bray in the newsrooms would cope with these shifts of position. So this is, I'll just run one short clip from it and then a longer clip a bit later on. Well, after that, which you haven't seen, by 1648 the Royalists had been defeated the second time round. But the the Levellers felt they'd been conned by what had happened, in particular in relation to what happened to the trial of Charles that we've just heard about. In 1649, Lilburn's New Chains Discovered was published, and he was put back into prison again. And then in May, we get the third agreement of the people, which is the sort of their cradle, their sort of battle cry of the Levellers, calling on the Parliament to abolish all arbitrary power. And I'll pick up a quote from this one. This is this other collection of Leveller documents. They're now demanding, as becometh a free people, thankful unto God for this blessed opportunity and desires to make use thereof to his glory, in taking off every yoke and removing every burden, in delivering the captive and setting the oppressed free. But of course that's not the way that Cromwell and the army grandees saw the situation. There was plans for a big agitators, the army agitators meeting in Bristol. And Peter Linebaugh, who people who've been to previous Radcliffe History will remember, in their another inspirational book, this one, The Many-Headed Hydra, he talks about the way in which Bristol became the kind of focus, it was a sort of stronghold of religious radicals. The intention was that these dissident groups within the army would converge on Bristol in order to develop a strong opposition to what they felt were the dictatorial tendencies of Cromwell, and also in opposition to the intention to use the army brutally, as it turned out, in Ireland. But Cromwell, with 2,000 cavalry and dragoons, moved against them. They fell into a trap at Burford and famously crushed the incipient revolt of the agitators and the levellers within the army. And three of the mutineers were executed at Burford. But that was very far from the end of the levellers. What then emerges are those who call themselves the true levellers, or the diggers, who set up their commune, I suppose, for want of a better word, at St. George's Hill. Now, the Communist Party historian Christopher Hill wrote this fascinating book, The World Turned Upside Down. But I have to say, dare I criticise a real historian, it seems to me puts too much stress on the distinction between the true levellers and the levellers. It seems to me, the book was published in the 1970s, it reflects the kind of debates that were going on, the kind of reform versus revolution kind of arguments, and that seems to be reflected in that in his book, The World Turned Upside Down. And I think he tends to, dare I say, overstate the difference between the groups. There obviously, it seems to me that any kind of radical group trying to create change is in effect an alliance of a spectrum of opinions. By the time that movement, the leveller, it soon became clear that Cromwell was equally opposed to the levellers as to the true levellers. Lilburn sympathised to some degree with what the diggers were trying to do, and spoke out in their defence, was once more imprisoned and put on trial. Geoffrey Robinson is very good in his book about the way in which that trial, I think it was the third trial of Lilburn, was incredibly important in establishing the right of trial by jury. He also established the right, there's a wonderful moment which we included in the programme, although I'm not using that extract, where they wouldn't allow him to go and have a pee. And so he insisted on having a pee, so the chamber pot was passed to him in the box, and he peed away and carried on his defence while he was doing so. I think there is a tendency, and I feel it myself, that to interpret these events and the whole Levelers movement and the Diggers movement in secular terms now. And I must admit, when I was taking that last quote there, I was sort of tempted to kind of remove the references to God and divinity and so on. But actually, it absolutely permeates everything that the Levelers and the True Levelers wrote. And I think we have, if we're to understand the thinking behind them, I think we have to try and make that kind of, however difficult some of us might find it to do that, you have to jump back two or three centuries into the kind of frame of mind and the thinking of that time, which where religious thought absolutely imbued everything that was said and done. I mean, for instance, I think Christopher Hill picks up on this very well. He says, for Winstanley was the leader of the Diggers, the True Levelers, as they call themselves. For Winstanley, Jesus Christ was the head leveler. Now, the Quakers grew out of the Diggers, and some of the Quakers, especially after the Restoration, lost hope that the kingdom of God could be achieved on earth, and tended to assume it was something that would have to be deferred until the hereafter. But democracy certainly didn't appear, and the democratic movement didn't disappear with the Restoration. The Inglorious Revolution of 1688 didn't make much difference either way, but the independents and Congregationalists kept the flame alive during the 18th century. And decisions within the independents, the Anabunwyr, as they're called in Wales, and the Congregationalists, were decisions by a vote of all the members of the chapel. While I was making, I don't know whether we've got this structure there. Well, we've got the first one. Should we run the first one? I can't understand. Oh, it's the second one. He has got the second one. Right. While I was producing, directing a series for Channel 4 about the history of Wales, The Dragon Has Two Tongues, and the extract I'm going to run from that is from the seventh in a 13-part series called The Gentry Century. The idea was that we have two presenters, one Marxist, Professor Gwyn Williams, and the other, Winfried Vaughan Thomas, very much anti-Marxist, or non-Marxist. And I was astonished to find, because I come from an Anglican childhood myself, from an Anglican background, I was astonished to find that in the chapel that we filmed at, a Congregationalist chapel, any decision, every decision, was simply voted on. You know, if it was a decision about whether Sunday school should be, the Sunday school outing should be held, they took a vote on it. And we included this as a way of kind of make, although the programme was about the 18th century, this clip that we're going to run now is uses a real-life Congregationalist chapel in West Wales. Programme. Okay. I'm running this in order to demonstrate the way that Leveller ideas continued into the 18th century through religious groups.
The gentry and the Church of England rode all over Wales as its lords and masters. But within that Wales there were these little centres of resistance and dissent, the chapels of the old dissent. Baptists, Independents, Presbyterians. Not many of them, maybe 5% of the people, but these were people with a punch. And no matter what variant of their own non-conformist religion they preached, within their chapels, they all practiced democracy. Nowhere was this more true than in this denomination. The Independents, Congregationalists, Anabunwyr, Oliver Cromwell's people. In those chapels, they recognized no authority except the congregation, and they decided everything by the vote. This attitude they took from their religion into the world at large. And during the 18th century, As the Welsh people learned to read, as these dissenters built up the academies that trained their ministers into first-class educational institutions, these people began to learn. They learned the new science, the science of Sir Isaac Newton. They learned the new questioning ideas coming in from France, the France of Voltaire and Rousseau. They are founding a fathers, after all, had cut a king's head off on principles, and they were themselves treated as second-rate citizens. So as they moved left in their religion, they moved left in their politics. And in the third quarter of the 18th century, people like these invented the doctrine of political democracy. Outside their walls, the gentry had Wales sewn up. But under the hooves of those horses, this little old mole of democracy was burrowing away. And
that was the late, much lamented Professor Gwyn R. Williams. You won't be surprised to hear. He was the Marxist side of the through the movements, like the religious movements he's just described, the Baptists, the Congregationalists, and the Quakers, many of these ideas crossed the Atlantic. And Peter Linebone and Marcus Rediker in their book talk about the way in which those ideas began to kind of germinate in the States. They quote from a newspaper of 1748, "All men are by nature on a level, born with an equal share of freedom and endowed with capacities nearly alike." And they describe the way in which that kind of thinking looks back to the Putney debates and forward to the Declaration of Independence. No taxation without representation, it could almost be one of the sort of leveller slogans. In the 1790s, following the American and French revolutions, these ideas, the leveller ideas, and the whole ideas that fermented during the Civil War came to the surface once again. And E.P. Thompson, in his book, The Making of the Working Class, talks about the way in which the organisation set up to resist, to oppose those ideas, specifically used the title Association for Protecting Liberty and Property Against Republicans and Levellers. Protecting property and claiming liberty brought, of course, in its wake even more savage repression than followed at Burford. But the memory of the Levellers refused to go away. It's always interesting to see the way in which historical events are commemorated and kind of resurface. And it's not surprising that in the Chartist period, in the late 1830s and 1840s, you get once again the reprinting of some of the Leveller pamphlets, and obviously an interest in the sort of ideas that the Levellers were generating. They call for annual elections of Parliament. Still, I'm afraid, it's manhood suffrage. Although there were strong women Chartist groups, the demand is still at this stage only for manhood suffrage. And I've just picked up quite recently, actually, that this term of the Leveller, that the Anglican preachers preaching against the Chartist movements use the term Leveller. Leveller is the kind of term of abuse that then returns to favour by those who oppose to Chartism and oppose to the democratic movement that it was introducing or reintroducing. It's more surprising to find that the Putney debates then resurface again at the end of the century, in the 1890s, in the Victorian period. I hadn't realised that until Geoffrey Robertson said that apparently one of the reasons for that was simply that they found the documents, they found these shorthand notes on the Putney trials, on the Putney debates. But also, I think towards the end of the Victorian period, it was quite a strong Republican movement, Charles Bradlaugh, MP, and there was some. And of course, there was then the emergence of new unionism, the trade unionism, that gave a new sort of force and energy to the debates about suffrage. And it's interesting, I mean, we tend to think of Bristol as being kind of on the periphery of all these things, but in fact, in, let's get my dates right, 1892, there was a major strike by dock workers and by, they were sweet workers, women sweet workers in Bristol, and it led to a huge demonstration in the centre of Bristol, cavalry charge once again, 57 injured strikers. As they say in this book, very difficult to get hold of. I've managed to find two copies of this book, actually. See if I can find it now. It's called An Account of the Labour and Socialist Movement in Bristol. Ill-informed persons often refer to Bristolians as sleepy, forgetting that proverbially they sleep with one eye open, and that the city's history abounds with instances of its citizens defending their rights and fighting for greater freedom. I haven't been able to find many direct references to the levellers in the labour and socialist movement that was emerging then at the end of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century. But certainly the hostility to monarchy and respect for democracy is very much there in the writings of Keir Hardie and the speeches of Keir Hardie. Monarchy, he said, always made militarism the very spirit of the nation, arguing that the soldier is the servant of the state, not of the monarch, and that Parliament, not the monarch, is the real state of authority. By 1928, the suffrage issue is off the agenda, but the interest in the levellers doesn't disappear. It reappears, unsurprisingly, in the wake of 1968, that time, I can recognise some people here who remember it very well, when it seemed like the whole thing was going to crack open and a whole new possibilities emerged. And you then get, for instance, Kevin Brownlow's and Andrew Molo, I think his name was, his film about Winstanley and the Diggers, and the songs like Leon Russellson's Stand Up Now, and then a whole spate of books. A.L. Morton's World of the Ranters, 1970, Christopher Hill's The World Upside Down, 1972, Aylmer's The Levellers in the English Revolution, 1975, and then after his death, Brailsford, The Levellers in the English Revolution in 1976. I rather obsessively gobbled up these books, and they're all, I hope, somewhere in this programme. Will we ever see it? Oh, thumbs up. Maybe I it's probably simpler now to run one into the other, isn't it? I think we'll do it that way. So we're back where we started. I hope I had intended to do the cycle. But anyway, let's just run these. This one extract, if people can remember where it was, it's in the early stages of the Civil War, and then the second extract was intended to be later in the Civil War. In particular, the thing I want to stress is something that I think will surprise you in the second extract.
Cromwell was forced to imprison him. Now, however, with the news that a royalist army is gathering in the north to counterattack, the general needs all the allies he can get, including the levellers, and it's thought that Lilburn's release will quieten their anger in London. Earlier today, I was at the prison gates to ask Lilburn on his release about the proposals of the leveller group.
Mr. Lilburn, reports say that you're suggesting the majority of the population should have the vote. Is that right?
The poorest that lives hath as true a right to give a vote as well as the richest and greatest.
Well, are you saying that the richest and greatest, our present rulers, are incapable of leading the nation?
What the name of ruffling silks and velvets? Your glittering gold and silver laces, are they not the sweat of our brows? And the wants of our backs and bellies? What's all the controversy? But whose slaves the poor shall be?
You may know that Lieutenant General Cromwell, who you once fought alongside, is at the moment heading north to take on the King's army. Do you not feel a sense of bitterness at his responsibility for your recent spell in jail?
If I felt I deserved revenge for a hard and sometimes starving imprisonment, I've had of late 20 opportunities to have repaid him to the purpose. But I scorn it, especially when he is so low. If ever my hand be upon him, let it be when he is in his full glory.
Mr. Lilburn, is it true that you're a card-carrying member of the Levellers Party?
We've just heard that Lieutenant General Cromwell has defeated the Royalists on the outskirts of Preston. Reports of the battle are only just reaching us, but we understand that the Lieutenant General has described it as a very hot dispute.
The king is an evil man in his actions. The army has fallen from all their promises and declarations, and therefore could not rationally any more be trusted by us without good cautions and security. There being two tyrants in the country, it is in the people's interest to keep up one tyrant to balance another, till we certainly know what that tyrant that pretended fairest will give us as our freedom. If the king is beheaded, our slavery for the future might probably be greater than our first.
135 commissioners have been appointed to try the ex-king, Charles Stuart, for his crimes against the state, and it's been confirmed today that they will have the power to order his execution. But the appointments haven't been without controversy, as Ian Breach explains.
It surprised many people when the government announced earlier today that John Lilburn, leader of the radical political sect, the Levellers, has been asked to stand as a commissioner. It was even more of a surprise when he refused the honour and returned to his home near Bishop Auckland in County Durham. Once more, it seems, the Levellers are criticising the government, this time over the legality of Charles Stuart's trial. They've already reiterated their demands for a more democratic parliament, but John Lilburn himself, always ready to pronounce on public issues, was not prepared to reveal his own private reasons for refusing the government appointment.
Mr. Lilburn, may I have a word? Mr. Lilburn?
Lilburn refused to confirm reports of growing differences between himself and moderate MPs like Sir Arthur Hazelrigg, the Governor of Newcastle. But the signs are that Lilburn is once again intent on becoming an embarrassment to General Cromwell and to Parliament. In their determination to embarrass all authority, it appears that the Levellers are using the King's trial to press for reforms in the law. Having opposed the King and fought for Parliament, the Levellers are now saying that he shouldn't be brought to trial until changes have been made in the way the law is administered. It's not a view that's held by many in government circles, however, and there's certainly no shortage of people ready to back Parliament's initiative and bring the former King to justice.
Where is that? Or where is that liberty, so much pretended, so dearly purchased? What now has become of that liberty that no man's person shall be attached or imprisoned but by lawful judgment of his equals?
Following the King's execution, the justices of Cumberland have announced that there are now 30,000 families without bread, corn or seed or the money to buy them. An appeal for aid has gone out to neighbouring Northumberland. The shortages are now so bad that some families have abandoned their homes and crossed the moors into Northumberland in an attempt to seek relief.
So, after these fair blossoms of hopeful liberty, breaks forth this bitter fruit of the vilest and basest bondage that ever Englishman groaned under.
The state of the economy has caused a lot of comment nationally, and now Parliament has decided to suppress unlicensed newspapers.
Well, consider how dangerous it is for one and the same persons to be continued long in the highest commands of military power, which was the original of most tyrannies in the world.
The Commons has also decided to send a military expedition to Ireland, where an armed rebellion has broken out against the new government. It will be led by Lieutenant General Cromwell himself.
The cause of the Irish natives, in seeking their just freedoms, is the very same with our own cause here, in endeavouring our rescue and freedom from the power of oppressors.
Following the decision to send troops to Ireland, there's news of more disturbances caused by the radical Levellist sect. This time, 1,200 soldiers who were to have formed part of the expeditionary force have refused to march any further until their grievances are settled. Here's Ian Breach.
Of course, it's been known for a while that there's Leveller infiltration in the army. Indeed, that may have been a contributory factor in the recent decision to send the Leveller leader, John Lilburn, back to prison. But in spite of Lilburn's imprisonment, the revolt in the army is so serious that the Lieutenant General himself is now on his way with 2,000 men to the Leveller encampment in Burford, Oxfordshire, to deal with the dispute. The Lieutenant General says he's intent on settling the differences in the army through peaceful compromise.
Pictures are just reaching us of the battle at Burford last night. Fierce fighting appears to have lasted most of the night around the village.
Here in Oxfordshire, on the banks of the Windrush and in the early hours of this morning, Lieutenant General Cromwell and his force of 2,000 men finally caught up with and routed the rebels who had spent the night bedded down here in the village of Burford. Outnumbered and completely taken by surprise, the rebels very quickly surrendered.
340 Leveller prisoners are now locked in Burford Church. Three of these will shortly face the firing squad.
Justify these actions done in the name of the army? Do you approve of the late shedding of the blood of war in time of peace? You soldiers are the men that keep us all in slavery.
Lilba remained a fighter to the end. He was, after being found not guilty by a trial for jury, he was expelled not by Charles II by the Restoration, but by Cromwell himself, by the Grand Parliament. The theme of this week is off with their heads. It's important to note that that's not what Lilburn himself advocated. In fact, he saw the execution of the king in 1649 as all of a piece with what Cromwell was doing in Ireland and what he was doing to the at Burford, indeed he was, because of his opposition to what was going on in the treatment of the king of Charles Stuart, he was even accused of consorting or conspiring with the royalists. It's interesting. I just wanted one last quote from Brailsford. I think it's a very, very, it's something he says that I find very, very interesting. This is what he says, comparing what was being advocated by the army and what was being advocated by the Levellers. What the Levellers advocated was of a much more modest scope, but for that very reason, it may have been a more dangerous threat to vested interests. It was a workable programme, not of revolution, but of reform. I think that's it's a thought I'd like to kind of leave us with, because it seems to me that the execution of the king, like the Tsar's murder by the Bolsheviks, antagonised key allies, pushing the regime into a harsher course of ruthless oppression. I know I'm saying dangerous things in this company, but that's the way I see it. And I have to say I'm struck by the way in which the Chinese communists treated their last emperor, who you may or may not know, became a gardener in the botanical garden in Beijing. Geoffrey Robertson, in his book, says that one of the really important legacies of the Levellers that survived was the insistence and the maintenance of trial by jury. I'd like to leave with you the thought that there may be another one too. That the most extreme course of action may not be the most effective one as a means of achieving permanent and fundamental change. Though striking lefter than thou postures, and I've done it myself, please don't. Thank you.
Could the Levellers have won?
Yeah, I think they could have. It was on the, you know, by the time they defeated Charles the second time round, I think that they could have pulled it off. You know, who am I to say? But it seemed to me that at that point, You can see it in the Putney debates. The debate was absolutely on balance then. Cromwell was having to make concessions, having to sort of win over the, because they were the bulk of the army. They were his army, you know. And I think he could have. Well, it's pointless in a way doing these kind of things. But I think so. Yes.
Would you consider that Oliver Cromwell was a leveller?
No, by no means. By no means. I mean, I think that, you know. The very fact that the idea that he then was going to hand over the inheritance to his son is proof positive that he any kind of aspirations, and it emerges from those Putney debates. You know, he was, to me, he was by then on the wrong side.
And Will? So if the Levellers didn't think that Charles I should have been executed, what do they think should have been done with him? Given what Geoffrey Robinson was saying earlier about the options that...
Well, I did wonder about that. I mean, he mentioned St. Helena, didn't he? Why not Elba? You know, I mean, the point was that Napoleon was stuck away there successfully. And, you know, it's a pointless exercise talking about the options that were available to different people in a different context at a different time. But
I'm not sure it is. I mean, if you're saying, it was an honest question. I mean, if the Levellers, I was honestly asking, you know, if they were saying we're against killing him, I mean, do you know what they were saying should have been done to him instead?
I don't, is the short answer. No, I don't. I think that sending him into exile was what they did with him, you know, with Lilburn himself. And I think, I don't know. Honestly, I don't have the answer to that. And I don't think, you know, I think most of the Leveller documents, their manifestos, their statements, and they don't say specifically what should be done. I think they saw it as a tactical mistake, really.
This is a question about the religion. You quite rightly pointed out that they saw God as the given.
Yes.
Did they see any contradiction between that belief and the relation with the established church and that power relationship?
Certainly they challenged the notion of. I mean, they were remarkably, for the time, tolerant about religion, about allowing religions other than those that they themselves supported to be given a voice. I think they were way, way ahead of their time in that respect for that period.
Yeah. I was thinking in terms of the power that individuals in the church had locally and in communities.
Well, I think they tended, obviously, to take that bit of the Bible that supported what they would. As you know, it's resurfacing now in America, isn't it? You know, that there was a very interesting Simon Sharma's last one about religion points up the way in which Republicans would use one section of the Bible and Democrats, particularly left-wing Democrats who are religious, will tend to take another section of the Bible. So I think that's the way they. I haven't said they got round it that way, but that was the way in which those debates tended to polarise. You know, you simply quoted back at each other different sections of the Bible.
Harry, what do you want to say? Has anybody else got a question? Okay. Right. Thank you very much, Colin. Let's give him a round of applause. Yeah, well, hopefully see you sometime this week. Wow.